we're going to go ahead and get started. You're here today for creating a legacy plan for your digital life. Hopefully you know that. I'm curious, we're going to find out a little bit today. Maybe you don't even know what that means. If you read the summary, creating a legacy plan can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So I'm going to outline what we're talking about. Mainly what I'm focused on here today is practical. So I'm going to talk about the ins and outs and really the important stuff that you might want to have prepared to help your loved ones or even help yourself in times of emergency, which I'll talk a little bit about too. So who am I? My name is Melody Condren. I'm the librarian at the University of Houston Libraries in Houston, Texas. I'm originally from Erie, Pennsylvania, right across the lake from Detroit. I've been in Houston for about a year and a half, and I'm shocked to be at a university. I was at a public library in Montana and a state library in Montana, which are very different than Houston. But my background and what I do at work is not at all, It's connected to what I do professionally and at home, but it's not the same. At work, what I'm responsible for is quality control of database records. That's so exciting. And basically when you come into the library and you look up a book and for whatever reason the wrong book cover is showing for the book you want, or you look at the subjects and it lists a subject that has nothing to do with that book, they call me and say, fix this stuff, fix these records. And I have a team of people who do that and also fix physical things on books. So if the label is wrong, if the call number takes you to the medical section when it's a book about dogs, we fix that stuff. So we're kind of a group of fixers. And I'm really passionate about quality control. It's a weird thing to say, but I love things to be organized and correct because they're useless otherwise. If you can't find things, you can't use them. So at home, I am a personal digital archivist. I got a lot of my grandparents' records and photographs. I have a photo collection that I estimate is between 30 and 40,000 photos that come from all the different great-grandparents that have trickled down to me, and I have my own personal photos. Of those, I have a little over 20,000 digitized and labeled in some fashion. No one is perfect, even librarians, so most of my collection, the important things, the stuff that I have really identified as being at risk, either because of age or because it's very important to me, that stuff is the stuff that I digitized first. So, oh, we're taking photos on the side too. I was wondering, no, that's fine. So what I've been doing with my personal life and my professional life, melding them together, is trying to come up with ways that I can use my skills of organization and helping people to get things put together in a logical manner, having to do with genealogy, having to do with photos, having to do with preservation and protecting themselves. So that's why I'm here today. So that's a little bit about me, and it did not advance. Okay, about me. That's a picture of my library on the right at the University of Houston. We have 42,000 students. It's a nice big city institution. I'd like to know a little bit about all of you, and I already asked a few minutes ago who was at some of the other sessions that were hosted here, but I'm just curious if you're willing to share the information. If you're not, you don't have to do anything. Who here has a will set up? Okay, that's pretty common, half and half maybe. Who has an email account? Okay. How about online banking? All right, and Facebook. Who's on Facebook? And I would say that's pretty typical. There was at least, I think everyone had an email account, unless I'm mistaken. But these are all things that we use all the time, and the same thing happens with digital planning as does with wills. We all know we should probably have one. Sometimes we're people who say, you know, I don't really have anything worth protecting or worth telling anybody about. And so my kids will figure that out, or I've shared my wishes with a few people just in verbally. And, you know, I'm confident they'll work those things out. Unfortunately, it's really difficult with digital objects, and you can probably guess why, you know why. Passwords, they tell you, create a password, nobody can guess. Don't share your password with anybody. And so where does that put our family? At the point that you are hospitalized or if something happens to you and you need to get a hold of those digital documents. In some ways, we might not want people in our digital documents. There might be journals that you do for yourself that you don't want to share with people. And there may be things in your email, like correspondence, that were never intended for your children or for other people who may be working with your will. So we're going to talk a little bit about what digital legacy planning is and how to get started. And some of the things we're going to cover today is going over a lot of things we can set up ourselves, our personal setup in a lot of our accounts, things that we can do in our different accounts like bills and things that we have to sign in on, email, also files and documents. We're going to go over what kind of things you may want to share or restrict. Photos and video are very often one of the big things here, because if you do have a will, chances are you haven't outlined who gets your photos in the will. Maybe I'm wrong. If you have a will, that would be great. But most of the time, people are worried about your financial assets. And in a lot of cases, when you draw up a standard will, no one brings that up to you. What about your photos? And if all of your photos are digital, sometimes that's sort of tricky because people don't necessarily know where they're located and they don't know how to get access to them. And I've heard a number of awful stories, you know, where your parents or someone else has the digital photos on a computer and they can't get into the computer and they don't know that someone can maybe help them break into a computer or hack a computer, and they just say, oh, I guess they're gone, and they pitch it. Sometimes you can't break in, or sometimes you don't know where they're held, too. So it's very important to plan for these things if they are important to you. As far as sharing and planning, we are going to talk a little bit about privacy. Like I mentioned, the whole debate about, okay, never give anyone your password. But if you never give anyone your password, how do we give people access? And that's certainly a huge debate. If you've hung out with any librarians, you know we're passionate about privacy. We don't want you to put yourself at risk. But on some level, especially when you talk about something like passing away, or if you talk about an emergency situation, we're talking about things that you want people to have access to. And in some cases, you don't need to give them your password. You just need to give them enough information. So things like bank accounts, they might not know where your bank accounts and your other accounts are. So even without a password, they don't even know to look for those things. And if you have passed away, sometimes an executor of an estate can get to those things. So there's some things that maybe you won't have to give passwords away for. We're also going to talk a little bit about the physical and digital lists, and just making lists of the things that you do need to keep physically and digitally, password-protected documents, and email alerts, which I'll talk about a lot more in depth. There we go. So other reasons to do digital legacy planning. This is a picture of my great-grandparents' house. The woman straight ahead to the right is my grandmother. And this is a regular family dinner. There were always that many people at the table. My grandmother was the oldest of seven, and they had a tiny kitchen, so this is where they ate. But really, family is the main reason that you do digital legacy planning. You want to make sure that anything you have digitally, if it was important enough for you to keep, we have so many things digitally, there's probably a lot of things you don't care about. But if you're here today, I'm guessing you also have some digital things that you're worried about and that you want to share. So really, it's about making a lasting legacy that you can give to those people and make sure that it survives. The second thing is to protect yourself and others. If you were here early, you may have heard that my house flooded 3 weeks ago. So 3 weeks ago, I lost a whole bunch of stuff, and I had to move out of my house for a couple months, and I didn't lose everything. I had flood insurance. We'll be okay. But there is a sense of loss when you live through a natural disaster, and we know a lot of people personally who did lose things. We were pretty lucky. But there were a lot of people in our neighborhood who weren't, and they lost family photographs, and it just breaks my heart. I'm actually getting weepy thinking about it. But you need to plan ahead for those things. So not just photos, but also in the wake of the flood, having access to my important legal documents was crucial. And I heard somebody in the earlier session this morning say, well, in an emergency, you're not going to care about some of this stuff. But I have to tell you, that's like all I cared about in the moment of. We had flood documents, like my flood insurance, my homeowner's insurance, and other things. I have two backups. I have one backup that is local and one that's offsite. And the one that was local was temporarily unusable because mainly that we had tried to get things off the floor, but we ended up losing cords to things, and the external drive got put somewhere we didn't know where it was, and they had covered everything in plastic while they were tearing out the drywall. I couldn't find it. So we lost access to that temporarily. I've since found it, and it's fine. But having the carbonite backup off-site and knowing how to get access to it was very helpful. If I hadn't been there, if I had been somehow injured in a natural disaster accident, my family may have needed access to those documents. And they know, my family knows, because I've planned ahead who my insurer are, or who my insurer is, and my policy number. And that's important. And they know how to get a hold of that, which is very difficult to do when somebody is incapacitated. And you don't want to take that for granted. So protect yourself. So the main things about how to get started with this, it feels very daunting. You have a ton of stuff digitally. Really, it boils down to two things. You decide what needs to be protected, and you inform the people who need to know about it that it exists. At the very lowest thing you can do, make a list of the important stuff and tell people that it exists. Even if you don't give them access, let them know that it's there so that they go looking for it later. So we're going to go through a whole lot of tools today that will help you do it in a lot more depth than that. But when it comes down to it, oh, it didn't advance. Sorry. Decide and inform. Number one, decide what you want other people to know about and what you want people to have access to. And number two is inform people that it exists. So some of the other things we're going to talk about very briefly, what a digital legacy plan is and isn't. It is not a will. If you have a will and it conflicts with anything in a digital legacy plan, the will is going to take precedent because it is a legal binding document. I'm going to have a handout in just a minute that will have a short legal information about the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, which is a legal thing that tells you what your relatives have access to if you were to die. And I will be handing this out, but there's other things on here as well, so I don't want to do it quite yet. But it says, the Act follows fiduciaries to manage digital property like computer files, web domains, and virtual currency. So that means that if you leave behind, if you pass away, that the people who settle your estate will be able to get, they have the right to get to your computer files, web domains, virtual currency, but it restricts access to electronic communications such as email, text, and social media accounts unless the user consented in a will, trust, power of attorney, or other record. So if you create a digital legacy plan that is not part of your will, and actually I think if you have a lot of digital stuff and you want to make it clear, you can also add it to your will and work with your lawyer on something like that. But if you have a will, but then you also have a digital legacy plan which you give out to family members, that could count as an other record that would be sort of a supplement to your will. And that is legal. If they say two different things, your will always takes precedent. So the question is here, what does a digital legacy plan even mean? What am I talking about? At the end of this first hour, I'm actually going to hand out a sample template of what it looks like. It's literally one page with a couple bullet points. And it says, here are some of the things I want you to know about. Here's how you can get access. Or in a couple cases, here are some things I don't want you to try and access, because these are things I'd actually prefer that you don't look for. Things like email accounts might be something I don't want them to have access to. But it's one page. That's all it is. And I made it in a Word document, and I can change it as need be. And I have a list of the people who have a copy of this. And every time I update it, I give it out to those same people and tell them, get rid of the old one, keep this new one. It's as simple as that. And you can add to it later. So if you decide that you want to list a few things and then you get more organized and you want to do more, you can do that. So the disclaimer on plans versus wills, this is not a legally binding document, but it could count as sort of a supplement to a will, depending on who you talk to and how many people are contesting it. But not everyone has a right to your digital stuff. So if you pass away and somebody wants to try and get into your digital stuff, they may not be able to, even if they are the executor, depending on what kind of digital stuff it is. So we're actually going to start off with an exercise, and I have some handouts. These first handouts are actually mainly brief. They're blank sheets. We have legacy planning assessment for digital items and accounts. So you can take a couple of these if you want. What I'd like people to do is start listing off what sorts of digital items they might want to include in a legacy plan and accounts that they have that they know that they might want people to have access to. And then there's another section for how important these things are. And what, you know, you could even jot down, one of them says important slash plan, some of the things of like who you think might go to them. So for account name, it might be like Facebook, not that important /mom question mark, because I might give my mom access to create a memorial of me in Facebook later on. So I'm going to hand these out now, and I recommend that as we move forward through the workshop, you continue jotting things down as you think of them, because we're going to go through a bunch of different kinds of accounts. I'm going to hand it out.
Okay.
And it's this is it's federal, but it's been there are individual state adoption of this act. And if you go to this website, it's the Uniform Laws website. I believe it was Howard, it was Donald Hawkins yesterday had it up on the screen.
Okay, that one.
Yeah, and different states have adopted this, and Michigan is one of the states. I'm sorry, I'm not speaking to the... Michigan is one of the states that has adopted this act. So it's at the top. And I will hand this out in a minute. There's just a few other things on it that I want to make sure I mention before I hand it out, so that I know no one's going to do this, but so that you're not just reading it instead of listening if we're talking about things. Okay. So does anybody have any questions about what to do with these sheets? Okay, I'd like to give people just a minute or two to start on them, if possible, just because I want to kind of have people thinking about what kind of accounts and what kind of digital stuff they have that they even might want to include on a digital plan. Any questions? Do people want to share what kind of things they're going to put on here? What accounts might you even care that people have access to or don't? Financial accounts, that's an obvious one, yeah.
Social media.
Why do you think anyone cares what happens to your social media after you pass away? This is actually a really hot topic. Some people are absolutely adamant. I've heard people be absolutely adamant that they want it shut down when they die. They don't want a memorial page. They want it shut down. They don't want all their photos and everyone posting sad things about them on their Facebook. And then there are other people who are absolutely adamant that they want, I want a place where people can write nice things about me and memorialize me. And really, this is very just as contentious as what people want in their own memorial service. A lot of difference of opinions. And in the case of Facebook, you have total control over this. I don't know if you know that or not, but you can say, when I pass away, if anyone informs Facebook, please shut it down. And that will be something we talk about in a little bit. So social media, financial accounts. The passwords. So, yep, and we're going to talk about passwords a lot today because I'm sure all of you have a few passwords. And does anybody, don't tell me, do not raise your hand to answer this, but I'm curious. There are people who have one password for everything. And that amazes me and terrifies me. I understand why people want to do that, but it's just so hard. If one ever makes you change, then you have kind of a weird offshoot of that. So we can just, yeah. And if people want more of these, not yet. If people want more of these at the end, I do think this is a nice jumping off point to kind of have a list going of what you're working on.
I have a password keeper.
Password keeper.
Which has over 200.
Right. And I don't know if you guys know about these. There are several programs that will create very in-depth, long, supposedly difficult to break passwords for you, and all you need to remember is the password to get into the password keeper. And in theory, that's great, and it works for a lot of people. I personally do not use those because it drives me kind of crazy, and if I don't have that, then I'm just out of luck. And I don't carry my phone everywhere. I'm one of those people who doesn't take their phone everywhere with them. And so that doesn't always work for me if I'm somewhere and I need to get into my accounts. So
you have a password manager. You do have one password.
That's true. That's true. And if that works for you, that is fantastic.
It's not all.
Right. Okay. So we're going to start talking a little bit about bills and accounts. So somebody already mentioned financial accounts. What we're talking about when we talk about important accounts, we're talking about things that hypothetically could put you at risk if they fell into the wrong hands. But that's exactly why they are important documents. They usually contain personal information about you that will tell people things about you that maybe you don't want them to know, things like Social Security accounts, you have your bank accounts, also things like legal and medical documents. Some of these, for example, if something happens to you in an emergency and you are incapacitated, unfortunately things like this do happen, so if you are in a coma, if you have been in a bad accident, it's possible your medical records might be needed. And that might depend on you. If you have allergies or history of something that you feel like your family should know about, people don't share this information. People are very private and tight-lipped about their medical conditions, even with family sometimes. A good friend of mine's father had cancer, got an operation for cancer, and recovered from cancer, and then told his kids that he had had cancer after the operation. And he didn't want to worry them, and he didn't want them to be upset. And while they understood that, they were just so terrified that something could have happened to him during that operation. And so I am a big protector and big advocate for people choosing and making their own choices, but I'm also a big advocate of things that are logical. And in an emergency situation, it would have been very difficult to find out if something had happened to him. And so telling people a basic amount of information, I feel like, is key. So less important things that might also come in handy to tell people about are utility and other bills, memberships, and social media, which we're going to cover later. So can anyone think of why utilities and other bills might be an issue? Let's say you pass away or you're gone. They keep coming. Is that a problem? Well, and that's the question. Does somebody have to pay them? The answer is sort of. What we found is I had, again, a friend, and I have so many of these are based on cautionary tales, but I had a friend whose husband passed away young, and he did the bills. She didn't know where the accounts were, how they were paid. Their checks got deposited into a joint account, and he set them up, and she didn't know how, and she wasn't on some of them. So she tried to piece it together. In the meantime, they shut off her power. Her husband has just died, and they shut off her power. And it's a simple thing. You think, like, okay, I'll be able to sort that out. But honestly, in the moment of emergency or crisis is really not a great time to try and sort those things out. It would have been really very helpful to just have a list of these are the utilities we use, here are our account numbers, and to make sure that people are on those accounts who need to be on those accounts. If you are part of a couple, I recommend that everyone be on utility accounts in a home that you both live in for that reason, just because it's so much easier to verify that you're the correct person, that you're allowed to make decisions for that account. Although legally you'll be able to eventually get to that, because they'll say, oh, someone has passed away and they'll have family contacts, it takes a while to sort a lot of that information out. So utility and other bills are something. So memberships, what kind of memberships might matter? What's up? Costco membership? If you can't get bulk foods in a crisis, you might be in trouble. Possibly. What it comes down to, gym memberships? Right, that's a good point. So anything that automatically deducts is probably a good thing to know about. And if somebody passes away and you look at their credit card records, you can usually see those auto deductions, or if you see their bank account records, you can see those auto deductions, and that can be a good clue to you that those are things that maybe you need to get in contact and put a hold on those. So certainly think about anything that auto deducts, because you don't want money coming out of an account when someone has passed away. Utilities that might be a problem. And then the other thing that might be a little farther out after something happens is anywhere where there is an online social or public-facing account. So you might have something like a blog or a website that you do on a regular basis, and you might just want to share with your family how to get into, if you have it on Blogger or if you have it anywhere else, how to get into your things and tell them, you know what, I'd like that to stay up, or you know what, if I pass away, please take that down. And, you know, usually there's some costs associated with keeping a website. You pay hosting fees and website fees, so things to think about. So those sorts of memberships might come into play too. Generally, with bills and accounts, what kind of things, does anybody have things that aren't on this list that they feel like they want to share? Okay. So we're going to go on to, and just so you know, we're going through this as an overview, and at the end we're going to talk about different ways that we're going to share things with passwords, and so we'll get to that a little bit more. We're sort of developing ideas and talking about the basics to begin with. So we're talking about email. So email is very tricky. I will hand this out now because we have, this document contains a number of different tricks and tips on things. The first part, thank you. This is a couple different pages. The first page, like I said, has the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, and it has the website that that came from if you want to see more information. And Michigan has adopted this, so it is included in Michigan's law. But it does say that the people who manage your accounts after you die don't technically, legally have access to electronic communications such as email, text messages, and social media accounts, unless you stipulate otherwise. So what that means is that what you're relying on is the law saying you don't have access. If you haven't told your family how to get into your email account, you're kind of at the mercy of who offers your email in some cases. And emails are not created equally, not by any means. So I listed a couple of the three most common. We have Google, Yahoo, and Outlook, just to give you some ideas of how these are different. The very first thing under the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, on page one of that handout, is the Google Inactive Account Manager. To my knowledge, Google is the only email provider that has an inactive account manager set up. Okay, and if you want to go and look at yours, and you're staying for the second half, I'd be happy to help you with that if you have a laptop with you. That was part of what we were doing today, is that we can do more hands-on for the second hour. You can sign into your Gmail account or your Google account and search for Google Inactive Account Manager, and there's a setup button, and there's a screenshot on here that shows you what it looks like. And what that means is it tells you there's like a timeout period. If you're like me, you log into Google every day if you have Gmail or something, or pretty often. You can say how often, if something happened to me, how long would I not have to log in before I put something in motion that sends this information out or gives someone else access to my accounts? So for me, if I don't log into Google for 30 days, something is probably wrong. I use it for work. I use it at home. I use it to check my email pretty often because I have a lot of contacts. My mom is far away. We share pictures. So if 30 days go by and I haven't logged in at all, chances are something is wrong. In which case, Google will send an email to my mother with my account information. And Gmail is one of the only places that will allow you to do that. Yahoo is completely on the other end of this. Yahoo makes it very clear in their user agreement that people, if you pass away, no one is allowed to have access to your data. They will shut it down. If you call Yahoo and say, my relative has passed away, can you help me get access to their account? They'll say, oh, your relative has passed away, we're shutting down their accounts right now. There have been a couple recent cases of people getting court orders to try and attempt and get that information. And to my knowledge, there has been one successful. Lance, do you know, is it just one? I thought we were talking about this yesterday. Maybe it wasn't you. But there was a case of a soldier. A soldier who had sent messages back and forth to his family, and he had died in action. And they wanted access to his emails, and Yahoo said no. And they did get a court order and eventually gained access. What they were lucky was that it wasn't deleted in the meantime because the people followed some legal channels that made it so that Yahoo couldn't delete those things. But Yahoo is in charge of Yahoo Mail. Also, Flickr is now owned by Yahoo. And Yahoo has also closed down people's Flickr's account when they know that people have died. So you put all your photos on Flickr, you keep all your email on Yahoo. A relative says, hey, they've passed away, can you give me access? No, and we're erasing it all. So there's a pro and a con to this. You, as an individual, aren't forced to use either product and can choose if you feel like one or the other makes more sense to you. I know people who don't want people to access their email after they pass away. And if you want to make it harder for your family to get a hold of your stuff. You could use something like Yahoo. I highly recommend that if you do that, you also tell your family so that they don't go through a heartbreaking looking for this, trying to break into your accounts, that you say as part of your legacy plan, email. I would appreciate you not trying to get into my email, and in fact, I've set it up to be deleted if I die. Then they don't waste time looking for it. They know what your wishes are. Now, if they choose to ignore your wishes, that's your family. But I think that there's something to that. If someone, and if you are one of the people who has those wishes, great. Yahoo may be for you. And in fact, Google could be for you too in that case, because Google also will have a setting in there that says after this period of time, we will delete your account. I just, you know, caution you that that's a dangerous thing to have in place. So Google has the legacy planning examples. The screen here, there's a screenshot that gives you a little bit more information about what it does, but if you stay for the second hour, we can go over that a little bit more in depth if you are a Google user. We'll talk a little bit more about documents later, but this also goes for all of your other Google-related things. So if you use Google Documents, Google Forms, if you have lots of other things in Google Drive, all those things can be managed with the Legacy Manager. So that's something to think about as you plan ahead. Outlook is sort of in the middle. They don't have any legacy controls specifically that say, oh, if I'm inactive, do this, probably because a lot of people use Outlook at work. So I think that would be difficult for a lot of organizations to have built-in programs that allow their employees to kill their accounts or send them to other people for access for privacy reasons. But Outlook has been sort of in the middle. They haven't been as hardliner as Yahoo about letting families get a hold of information. Usually you have to provide some documentation. So if a family doesn't have a password for your email, you can petition Outlook, and usually you have to be the executor of a will and have, usually it's a death certificate or other information. Now again, if you're in an emergency, if you're in a coma, you probably would have to do something like, power of attorney, or that when people are incapacitated and someone else is making decisions for them, that would probably work as well. If you are using something other than these, I would highly, highly recommend that you look at your email fine print and see what it says about what happens if you die. Most large providers have some sort of policy, usually to protect them, not you. So it's the kind of thing that you should know what they say so you can be prepared. And if it doesn't work for you, you have other options. These are free tools. And as much of a pain as it is to change providers and change email addresses, if it really is not a tool that works for you, I recommend that you switch. Yes?
Well, the thing to remember about any account that you use at your place of work is virtually every business will claim ownership of that. You don't own your own email account. They own that account. And so you really have very, very few options
right there
because they're going to claim 100%, and they may or may not choose on a healthy basis
right to
work with a family.
And I apologize. That was actually, I should have mentioned this, but this mainly goes for personal. I mean, we are talking about personal legacy plans, but you do not own a lot of your stuff that you create at work. And it depends on where you work, how big the place is, what privacy and policies they have in place. But usually you are not allowed to switch email providers from who you use at work because they have an IT department and a tech department who need to be able to have access to everything. And you may not own those things. That is absolutely true, which is another great reason to not do a whole lot of personal emailing using your work account. And it puts you at risk, too, because technically your employer is allowed to read most of your work email. So, except the State Department, right? Then, yeah. And a lot of small businesses and other things, they have a different system. If you work for a nonprofit or a small business, sometimes you have a Google account. And depending, my mother works for a nonprofit, and they use Google for their email. And you know, that's, in my thinking, it's actually very helpful because you can designate a second person who has access to your account in Google. I didn't mention this here, but for work purposes, if you're using Google for work, you can actually set up a second person to have access to your account. This sometimes works for husbands and wives. It also works for bosses and people who work for them. Usually they have their own password. They cannot change your password without your permission, but they do have access to your email. And so that way, if you quit or something happens to you, the business doesn't go under, which is another thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. I don't know how they would shut it off. I mean, if you're using it as a POP account into your mail locally, that might be different. But if you're logging in online, they can't turn that off.
Yeah, they can.
Can they?
Oh, yeah. As an IT guy whose company also uses Gmail, they will typically set it up. They have administrator privileges.
That's actually what I'm talking about. It's like you add another person.
So a company that gets Gmail will set themselves up so that they have administrator-level permissions, and they can selectively let you do or not do things.
Huh.
So they may or may not let you do, for example, the 30-day option. But they can turn that stuff on.
Right. Well, I apologize. I apparently don't know about the corporate side of this. What I know about is the general setup if it's on the online system of Google and Gmail. So it doesn't surprise me at all, but that's a good thing to know. No, I'm a very big proponent of people sharing and giving information because it helps everybody, and I don't know everything by any means, so yes.
Your point's well taken. Keep your personal and business life 100%
separate. And we're all not guilty of that at all.
No, not at all.
No, not at all. So, yeah, you have a comment back there.
Yeah, I have a U of M alumni account, which just routes my UMich to my Gmail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, and that's something to think about, that if you do have something like that, and I'm sure you would do that because you want to keep hold of your alumni account as well, and then if you ever want to change from Google, you could still have that same alumni account.
When you get around, you know, using business accounts, personal stuff, what you do is you set up maybe another Gmail account that's just for this. You CC yourself on the work account for the things that you want to keep, as opposed to your own Gmail.
Yeah, in some ways that's good. What I wouldn't like about that, and I'm not saying it doesn't work for you, would be then you technically have two copies of everything. And if you're someone who's constantly trying to get rid of some of the stuff that you don't want bulking things up, so if you CC it, then you have it in one place and you have it sent to the second place. And then you got to spend extra time deleting. And that's just me. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. And if you do have, absolutely, if you have a work document that you do want to keep or has personal things and you want to send it on, or just forward it on if it's completely personal, for sure. So. Yes, if you set it up in an active, the question was, if you are gone and you've given permission to someone else to access your account, can they shut it down? And the answer is yes. Either you can set up the inactive account manager to shut down after a period of time, or you can give access to someone else, and then they will actually have full access and the ability to shut down the account. So yes. Right, and that's more of like a privacy thing, but
yep.
What we're talking about as far as legacy planning, you know, it's a little, yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about files and documents. And I kind of break these into two main areas and then kind of the extra note about Google Docs. Personal documents are things like journals, personal writing, things that you may have, letters from people, correspondence, that's not medical or legal or financial. But it's not a work document either. So it's things that you may have worked on, projects you may have done. I have a lot of gardening plans. So I have like all sorts of different things I've drawn up for gardens, and I keep track of what I plant every year. So that's like a personal document to me. Then you have work documents, which as much as we say we don't want those to mix with personal documents, they sometimes do. And sometimes you have those on your work computer. And then we have a kind of a special note on Google documents. Whether they are personal or they are work documents, Google documents can easily be shared with other people. Ownership, either editing rights or just viewing rights. So if you keep any of your things on Google Docs, you can set it up so that someone else even if they don't have an active account manager, has the viewing rights to those documents. In the case of personal documents, that's really up to you. If you want to give people access, you could, like we're going to talk about in a little bit, have like a password sharing or an if I die kind of thing where they can, or if you tell them, you know what, I'm going to give you access to this document just in case, but it probably won't mean anything to them until later. Work documents, I absolutely believe that you need to give other people editing rights. In fact, I'm a big fan of using Google Documents for work documents, or having work documents that you have multiple editors on, so that if something happens to you, you aren't messing up your workflow at work, that other people are going to have a hard enough time if something happens to you, making sure that you are not the only editor on important documents. They probably don't need every little thing that you're working on. So the options in this case are three things. Shared location and ownership, which I've already talked about, using things like Google Docs, using Dropbox, shared folders on Dropbox or similar functions. That works for work documents and personal documents, giving people that sort of shared location or ownership. Giving them a copy of important documents can be helpful. If you have a family tree, this is one of my passions, genealogy. One of the biggest problems that genealogists have is that they are never done. If you do genealogy, you know this to be true. So you can keep going back and keep looking for more relatives and keep trying to fill in more information. And the issue with that is that sometimes that means that genealogists never complete or finish, they don't create a finished product. And so what I tell people is that they should try maybe annually to just output the basic data of the family tree and then put a version number on it with the date. And do give that to as many people as possible. So that's important information. If something happened to you and you've been spending 10 years working on your family history, for gosh sakes, just give people a copy and put a note at the bottom or put draft across the front or something so that they have the basic data even if you weren't quite finished. And tell them you're not finished or put draft across the front, but give them a copy so they have that basic information. And in that case, either in a footnote or up at the top, put the date and the version number if you want to, like, you know, and something like that. So giving them full copies is the second option for some of these documents. And the third is to give them access through passwords or full access to your computer, which is what we're going to start talking about. Photos and video, and then we're going to talk about, sorry, I almost forgot about photos and video. The biggest thing that you can do with photos and video is to share them. Most people, this is why they keep photos and video, is to share with loved ones and family. You could also be an artist or someone who takes a lot of artistic photos for yourself, and that's fine too, but chances are you're less likely to worry about those after you die. Maybe I'm wrong. Some artists really do want that for sure, but if you're kind of like an amateur or someone who's doing it for yourself, maybe the digital legacy planning doesn't matter as much. In the case of my photos, I have several generations worth of photos. What I personally do is pull those all together and make albums, and I use Google Photos. There are lots of platforms that you could use. But I provide full download rights to the people who I give access to my albums. So I have a photo of the 1940s from the Calabrese Salarino side of my family, which is the Italian side, and I put up several hundred photos, and I shared the private link, so this is not easy to find online. It's just people who have the link, sent it to all my cousins, all my aunts and uncles, and said, download the ones that are your favorites. I highly recommended that they download the ones that they like the best. If you haven't heard it before, there's an archiving term called locks. Lots of copies keep stuff safe. That is the best thing you can do for your photos, is share them. Everybody would love to say, oh, I have 10,000 photos. I have them all in this like place, and I'm going to share it with things. And the fact of the matter is that if your children or your loved ones go in there and see 10,000 photos, they're not going to go through 10,000 photos. They might save them if they can get access to them, if they're organized. It's helpful to find that. But most of the time, they're going to look for kind of the best of situation. I'm not saying you shouldn't make them all available. In my legacy plan, people have a list for photos. They know they're on my external drive. They know my password to get in and get my photos in their entirety. However, these 1940s photos, all the people who knew these people were so happy to get these photos. Was this all the photos I had from the 1940s? No. It was the Calabrese and Salarino ones where we knew the people in the photos. So the pictures were people who everybody knows. my grandparents, their sisters and brothers, etc. There were several photos from my grandfather's album, and I don't know who those people are. There were pictures of my grandfather's friends when he was in the Navy in World War II. And some of those are really interesting, and I did put a few of them in there, but there were several that were sort of blurry, and we don't know who the people are, and those I didn't include for the sharing, but yes. Right, and I actually had a whole different album for that where, do you know these people? And that was a different album for several decades, actually, not just the 40s. So this was sort of like, I have several people who wanted to have these photos and were a little overwhelmed with the size of the collection that my grandparents have left behind. So this was, again, sort of like the best of, and did include all the pictures of recognizable people. And then the people who wanted to help me with the additional project, I have a Do You Know These People file. But yeah, thank you for remembering that. And again, it's all about personal choice. If you want to put them all in one album, that's great too. But I highly recommend that photos, you could share them publicly, you could share them on private accounts, you could again create copies. Yes. It doesn't let you do facial recognition, but there is tagging. Mm-hmm, there is tagging. You can. What I tried to rely on, knowing people would download things and take it out of Google, was I gave them somewhat descriptive names as well as I could. And there is some photo things that I embed in the photo, which is a whole different conversation. We could have a whole different class just on that. And if anyone's interested, actually, I have a website where I put up my big photo project where I embed metadata using Picasa and Google Photos, and that's at my website, melodycondren.com/PDA. And there is a poster that I did for this conference last year that tells you how I scanned them, how I added metadata for the names of the people in the photos. And what metadata is it's actually information that's inside the file. It's inside the photo file. And so I used facial recognition to find people. And then once they were all in folders, I added the tagging in Picasa to add a tag for the name. And then that name was embedded into the file. And now if I send it to my mother and she searches for that name, even if it's not in the title, it'll show up. It's never easy. It's always a big project. And then access again. So sharing is great. Copies are great. I'm not one of the librarians who says don't use CDs and DVDs. Just be aware that they don't last forever. And don't make sure they're not your only copy. They shouldn't be your backup. They should be a way of sharing. And as someone pointed out in the morning session, you're seeing fewer and fewer computers that have CD drives, so it's going to become harder and harder to do that. The same goes for flash drives. Flash drives are not great for long-term storage. No matter what we want, they're just not. They have a limited number of rewrites on them, and they can corrupt. They're great for if you have multiple copies of things, keep maybe one on a flash drive. Don't make five flash drives and feel like you're covered. Maybe make one flash drive, one external drive, one on-site, one off-site. But yeah, just really in general, external hard drives and web backups are really what a lot of people are recommending. So social media. Facebook is the only one of the big five, and it messed up my slide here. I had those were together. Those are the big five. Those are the top most used social media sites in the United States, not in the world. We have some kinds in China and a couple other places that we've never heard of. That we don't use over here. But Facebook is number one by far, and 1.09 users log in every day to Facebook. That is crazy. That's a lot of people. Facebook does have legacy options, and on the handout I gave you, it's actually the last thing on that handout, is how to add, change, or remove a legacy contact. So that's a screenshot from their help site that explains to you how to add a legacy contact. The bad thing about it is it has to be someone who's on Facebook. So you can't name someone who doesn't use Facebook as your legacy provider. You can also put it in there that you just want your account to be deleted if you pass away. Again, tell your family if that's the case, because you don't want to surprise them. And if they contact Facebook and say this person has passed away and you have set it up that your account should be deleted, they'll let your family know if they request, if they say, oh, they've died, we want to have a memorial page. They'll say, sorry, they've actually said they don't want a memorial page. But again, why surprise your family at a hard time? Tell them ahead of time. Or talk to your family about it and see if they feel passionate about memorializing you on Facebook. I realize I did skip one of the things on the pages on here. I wanted to talk about encrypted Microsoft files when we talked about documents. As we can go back very briefly to documents. When we start talking about access to documents, one of the things you can do with any kind of Microsoft document is encrypt and password protect it. Any Microsoft document that includes Word, Excel, PowerPoint, they all have the ability to be password encrypted. So the password encryption is pretty good as long as you're using, I think it's anything after 2007 on Word, or 2007 on any of the Microsoft things. And so it's actually a pretty good, unless you're using one of the very common passwords, 12345, password exclamation point is really popular right now. So as long as you're not using a very easy to hack password, it is a pretty good encryption service. And so if you have a journal, if you have documents or letters or things that you've saved into a Word document and you don't want people to be able to access those, you can set up encryption. And page 2 of this handout, that's the back of the front page there, shows you how to do it. This is, again, right from Microsoft's support help screen to encrypt the document and add a password. What I highly recommend this for, if you use it for nothing else, and I'm going to say here, and I'm not going to out any of you if I see you looking very guilty, if you have a document called passwords, and you know who you are. This is something my mother did for a long time, and I know other people who've done this, and I know it's very frustrating if you don't use a password program to try and keep track of all of your passwords. If you are going to track your passwords, number one, don't call the document passwords. Call it something else. Make it something funny or ridiculous that you're not going to forget, but really calling it passwords makes it really easy for any hacker who might get access to your computer to search for that document. And then beyond that, I highly recommend encrypting it. And then if you need to get in there to find your passwords, it's pretty safe. Is it unbreakable? Nothing is. But it is fairly much safer than not having it encrypted and password protected. Also, as we get into kind of sharing things in a few minutes, when you share documents that include account numbers or other things that you want to share with friends and family, you can use this encryption to put in a password that then you share with your family what the password is for the document that gives them the big list of your accounts and things. So I'm sorry I skipped that during documents. So after social media, we were still on social media. Facebook is the only one that has legacy options. Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Instagram all have a different way of dealing with this. Most of the time, if you let them know that you've passed away, they will take down the account. If someone lets them know that you have passed away, they will take down the account. In some cases, there's mixed reviews. Twitter will usually work with the family to get like an archive of the tweets. That's because Twitter is all public anyway, so it's something that is not behind a sign-in wall or anything like that. LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Instagram will usually take down the accounts at family requests, but they don't usually save a whole lot. So if it's something that's important to you, you might want to check it out. Yes?
Can you click down to buy your Facebook posts?
You can, with a caveat. This is what I was talking about 2 days ago at the conference. Facebook has a way to pull out all your posts. It doesn't include any of the social aspects. So it includes all your posts, but none of the comments on your posts. So the whole social part of social media is missing completely. Nope. It's a privacy thing. It's Facebook protecting themselves from someone else saying, you gave someone my comment that I thought was protected by password, and et cetera. There are companies now that are starting to breach that, and we talked about it a little bit at the conference. There are books that will let you print all your Facebook posts with the comments. So they're getting around that somehow, and I'm looking into that. But the actual built-in dump of your posts from Facebook does not include the comments. It includes images, yeah. Okay. So here are your options, and we started kind of alluding to it, but we're going to talk about it a little bit more in depth. So privacy, how much to share? Anytime we start talking about giving our passwords to other people, we really need to be cognizant of what we're putting out there. I would caution you that anyone you choose to give a list of passwords to or information about your accounts should be the same sort of person that you would want being the executor of your will. If you're talking about digital documents, if you were in the conference yesterday, you heard Donald Hawkins say, don't give somebody who isn't digitally literate all the passwords because they don't know how to deal with any of your digital accounts if they're not technologically literate. So choose someone who you feel like could handle this and could handle closing accounts if that's what you want them to do, who could handle finding and logging in even if they hit some roadblocks. So that's the one thing. As far as privacy goes, I think that in general, you probably want to have a list of your major accounts, which you're going to have listed here. What I do is I have an if I die document. It is on my desktop of my computer, and I have also sent a copy to my mother and another relative. It is password encrypted. We all know what the password is. I do not change the password. And I know that I probably should, I could send them a new one periodically, but I do update it occasionally and tell them to throw out the old one and have the new one. And the main things that are on there are my insurance information, my bank accounts. So if you do not feel comfortable giving people your bank account numbers, you can at least tell them where things are located. We talked about this at the beginning of this session. So if you don't want to give them all the numbers of everything, you could just tell them at least what companies they're going to. I have accounts, bank accounts at the following banks. So they can go there and say, I'm the executor of so-and-so's will. I don't know the bank account, but here is their name and their social security number, et cetera. And usually the bank will, the bank has to help them. It's just sometimes tied up a little bit longer if you don't give them account numbers. Things take longer. So password protect documents and passwords. This goes both ways. In my digital legacy plan, which I will hand out to you, which is more like an example plan, you will see that I have a couple things in there where I say, basically what I gave is my family access to my whole computer. And I took the documents I didn't want them to open and password protected those. So I say if you hit a program that is password protected, please assume that that was on purpose and respect my privacy and don't go into those documents. So I worked it the other way. I decided to give them access. You can give people the login to your computer if you feel comfortable doing that. And if you do that, I would highly recommend that you maybe consider doing it for family members who don't live nearby. So that makes you feel slightly safer. If they live in another state, they're unlikely to come to your house when you're not home and go into things. You know, if you're talking about a roommate or someone else who's right there, they might get curious periodically. So all of those things are really a personal choice, how you choose to share. But password protecting documents, doing as much legacy setup in the programs that you use, including email, documents, online accounts, anything that you can set up beforehand is great. And then you create a one-page plan that outlines it all so you know what the plan is and you tell your family what the plan is. Email alerts and trigger systems is the last thing I'm going to mention here. There is a company, I thought I had the website on here. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to find it real quick. Is it on here? I apologize. It was on one of my... The Digital Beyond. There's a website called The Digital Beyond, which lists a long list of services preparing people for how to deal with their digital documents if they die. So they have things such as if they send you an email once a month and you have to reply to it or press a button and they know you're still alive. And if you don't do that, if you don't respond to them, they have a protocol put in place, things like that. But there are lots and lots of different options for how to protect your data and make something trigger if you're not responsive or you don't log in periodically. Digital Divide is not a service provider in itself. It has a big, long list of resources that you can look at. So what I have here now, the last thing I'm going to hand out is a legacy planning document. I thought I had two. Okay, yes, I do. I have two documents left for you. The first one is a legacy planning template. It has kind of an example. It says, I have provided a list of companies' accounts to, and it has a place for a person's name. So this is kind of what it might look like. This is an example of what it might look like. And then the second thing, you can take those two, okay, is kind of an overview of what I've been talking about with a list of the options. This is going to be personal to everybody. Personal digital archiving starts with personal because we all have different needs and expectations, and we have different things that we want to protect. So this is not something I can tell you what to do and you say, okay, I'm just going to do that and I'm done. You have to decide, and then you have to inform and tell people. This is what we talked about in the beginning. So this second document, the legacy planning document, has a summary that kind of sums up what I've been talking about for the last hour. And then it has 10 things that are sort of a breakdown of 10 possible options you might want to take advantage of. Number one, share your whole computer. Number two, encrypt or password protect documents. Number three, create shared folders on a cloud. Number four, create shared or open albums on sites like Google Photo or Flickr. Number five, share low importance account logins. And you know, I didn't go over that, but that's like, have a stupid password for your unimportant things and tell people, you know what, if it's something that's not important, like my mileage account or something, you know, just tell them I use the same password for that and I never change it, something like that. Choose emails based on legacy planning availability. Plan for your social media accounts. Use a digital legacy planning service, and that's where it lists the Digital Beyond as the website to look at. List accounts without giving access so people can find them even if you're not willing to give out numbers, and provide family with a list of accounts that you prefer that they not attempt to access. So this is kind of the summary document and the example legacy plan. So we're going to have a few minutes. We have gone an hour. We have a few minutes where we're going to talk about this and answer any questions, and then we have the time set aside for the next hour where if people want to stay and they brought a laptop or if they want to start working on paper, I do highly recommend that you at least try and work on those lists that I gave you at the beginning before you leave in case you have any questions while I'm here. But I would love to see all of you get started on this very easy to start document, and it is easy to start. So let's get started with some questions. Who's got questions? Yes. Oh, yes, we need. Thank you. Oh, they're recording it.
Nobody mentioned audio file storage or quality of or sizes or anything like
okay.
that.
Okay. As far as backing it up to share with people, or you mean
to store it, because okay. I've saved something, I'm not sure how long ago, and now it comes and even the sound is not loud enough. I'm not sure.
Okay. Audio is very tricky. You want to try and keep it in some of the main audio types, which would be like MP4 or a WAV file or some of the other very well recognized. And what you might be experiencing is that if you recorded that a long time ago and then it you tried to open it and it opened in a different program, it might have turned it into a different kind of audio file to try and read it. And sometimes it changes the file just by opening it. If you've noticed that it changed over time, that's probably what happened. Audio is very tricky. In the case of things like, just as far as the legacy planning goes, in the case of things like music, you should be aware that you can't leave your music collection to your kids if it's digital and you bought it digital. If you have iTunes music, you purchased that and you licensed it to yourself, not your kids, and they can't have it. So just so you know. But yeah, if your own. Well, and sorry, MP3s should be fine. As far as you want it to have a program type that's going to open in lots of different types of programs, and it sounds like so you have them in MP3s.
I record with something called Audacity. Mm-hmm. But then it packages it into MP3s.
Okay. Okay. As far as preserving it and sharing it, the same rules apply, but as far as helping you with the audio problems, that is not my specialty. Lance, do you have any like background with audio?
So I think Audacity saves in WAV, WAV format. Yeah. So WAV is uncompressed. So the difference between an MP3 and a WAV is going to be larger. But
I have an engineering degree. That's not the problem.
Okay. So well, I don't. What's the?
Elon automatically now records directly in packages in the client tree without my doing anything. So it doesn't store it in the long form.
Okay. I don't. When I've used Audacity, you can choose how to save what you're doing. So I'm not. I'm not sure how to fix your. I'm not sure. I would just say, usually we, you know, if the size of the files doesn't matter, that just we recommend doing Wave, just because it's not, you can edit it then and save it, and it's not going to recompress it like it would with a MP3. But yeah. Right. So it's a choice, right?
It's a larger file size. Right. But yeah, and I apologize. Audio is not my area of specialty. I do have audio files. I save like voicemails, and I've turned a lot of old cassette tapes into audio that have family members talking on them in oral histories. But I sought assistance for some of that because audio is not my area of specialty. As far as saving it and preserving it, and I mean, all of these things still apply to that, to trying to make people still have access. But as far as the quality of files and things, I'm not really qualified to help you with that. I wish the people from this morning were still around. I feel like Francis may have helped with something like this. But
there's lots of online guidance for what kind of audio files to use, you know, the format.
There's lots of guidance, you know, as far as the formats and. Okay. And all of that online.
Yeah, and it sounds like she's having a specific problem with losing quality or sound, that it's not as loud. And
digitally recorded, so now when you listen to it, it's like you faded or something.
That's interesting.
Right.
I'm afraid of the lots of things that I'm recording now.
Are you, now, I have to ask. I mean, I'm thinking of like the easiest solution is it just one or two, or is it all of them? Right. Because if it's one or two, maybe that day something was wrong with the microphone or something was covering, you know, and you say, well, if it's one or two, or maybe one or two files got corrupted. But if it's all of them, then I feel like you probably need to look at the overall system. But, yeah, I apologize that that's not my area.
Yeah, but audio software can compensate for those kind of problems.
Yeah. So, yes. Passport copy. She wants to know about making passports. This is a controversial thing, too, because when you scan legal documents, people feel like you're put at risk. I do keep a copy of my passport. The State Department and several other international travel sites tell you to keep a copy of your passport scanned. If you are stuck internationally and your passport gets stolen or taken, it is a lot easier if you have a scan. Sometimes they'll let you travel a little bit more than depending on where you are, and also it helps your consulate get you a new passport if you have all of the codes and numbers on there. I keep mine on an encrypted cloud storage, so I have Carbonite, which is encrypted, and I keep a scan on there that I could get to it over the internet if I needed to, if mine were gone and I was somewhere else, as long as I had internet access. And then they also tell you if you're traveling international to keep a photocopy, a color photocopy as well with you. So, yes.
I have a question similar to the audio question.
Okay. I'll do my best.
Maybe a little bit different, but I have some old real audio format files that I threw them in my digital archive years ago, and now it's hard to find a program that'll open it and be able to convert it to a Wave so I can save it for a longer period of time. But the more general question is, she started saving stuff 20 years ago or 10 years ago, you put it in your digital archive, what formats do you use to make sure that you're going to be able to read it?
Yeah.
10, format. 20 years later.
Yeah, no, this is an excellent question and one that comes up a lot at this conference, as well as among people who do this sort of stuff. There are, in a lot of cases, like early on, if you were around 20, 30 years ago and saving things early on, there was no standardization or recommendation, and lots of files got created that were using proprietary methods. Those are the things that give people a lot of trouble now. And now, librarians and archivists and other people who store things en masse are really pretty big on trying to use open file types and file types that aren't owned by anyone. So when we talk about WAV files, we talk about PDFs, because they're not proprietary and hopefully will have a staying power over time. Now, that doesn't solve your problem. You have the old files. What I have a dream of having a wiki at some point, like an online site where archivists and people who are doing this sort of conversion on a regular basis, when they find something that works, that they can start sharing with each other. Off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that, but I know people who probably do know the answer to that. And so I would love to see there be a better way of saying, I have this type of file. How do I convert it to this kind of file? There are literally thousands of file types that are still in existence, but so many that are no longer in use and you can't find any way to open them. And there are usually conversion tools. You just have to do a little bit of searching. And I'd be happy to help you when we move into this next section, and I'll do some searches around and see if I can find a good program. Sometimes there are also recovery places that you can go to a vendor and you can say to them, I have this type of file, can you convert them to something else? And you can pay for it. But before you do anything like that, there are probably some free tools out there. But it's a huge problem.
Yep. I'm not so interested in the conversion necessarily, but in the file format types. Like 10 or 20 years from now, I'm not sure people will even know what a PDF file or a Word document is necessarily.
Well, Word is proprietary. I'm not suggesting you use Word for everything. Yeah. PDF is an open format that in the earlier panel today, someone said it belongs to us all. Adobe donated it to the public domain, and we all own PDF. So there are certain formats that are now built and kind of encouraged and will perpetuate because now they've been developed as the standard. And so because they're the standard and more recommended, it's unlikely, and I'm not going to say impossible, but it's unlikely that they're going to go away in the near future. When you talk about the next 20 years versus the last 20 years, it's much different because people for a long time didn't know what was going on. Oh, a proprietary, oh, we have a program that does this, program that does that, and you have all these different little file types. Now everyone recognizes that it's a big problem to have all those file types that don't work together. And so now you see Word letting you save and export as PDF, which you couldn't do way back in the day. I mean, now people are saying, we want to give you the ability to save in one of these sustainable formats. Will it be forever? Maybe not, but it's better than something that's proprietary now because PDF is not proprietary. My best answer.
Is it okay if I jump in?
Yes, please do.
Yeah,
please do.
So it's essentially what you want to do. It's not, you're not going to find a file format that's going to live forever, but the focus on the openness of it makes it really likely that when that format dies, there's going to be tools for you available. So A, it's not going to die as quickly as a really niche proprietary format, but that anyone in this room, if they wanted to, can build a PDF converter, can build a PDF validation tool because it's all open. So, and then when you get into things like PDF and TIFF and JPEG, there's trillions of those, right? Mm-hmm. So there's there's a really good likelihood that you'll be able to migrate it when that time comes, and that time won't be like next week. A really good resource is, I can never remember the URL, but if you just Google Library of Congress File Formats.
Oh, thank you.
They
have
a great file format sustainability site, and they'll say if it's open, that they thing I always look for, and I use that in my job as a digital preservation person, is if they say, this is a format we use to preserve stuff, that says something. It doesn't say, you'll forget it forever. But it will say that it's probably not going to go away really soon, and that there'll be a lot of tools open for you when it goes away.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because at the point that the Library of Congress has a million things in TIFF, if TIFF goes away, the Library of Congress will share with you what they're doing, and that'll be a really good tip.
Yeah,
a billion TIFFs. Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. They'll have a plan probably in place. For genealogy, if any of you do genealogy, Judcom is what you want to use. Any genealogy software that is worth using will export genealogy into GEDCOM files, and Ancestry does, and most other softwares do. If you've been a genealogist for very long and used any of the tiny tools that are out there, and then seen them come and go, and you feel like you've lost something or feel like you have to make weird copies of all of your data, it can be very challenging. There's a lot of small genealogy softwares, but You can export into GEDCOM, which is the core genealogy files, so you save all your basic data. And yes?
How long the PDFs? Because if we have older PDFs and now they're saying there's a new version, so how many PDF formats can you, do you have to... To redo the old PDFs into new PDFs?
You don't have to redo your old PDFs. It's just the newer versions of PDF have more options. What were we talking about this morning with the PDFAs?
That they carry the fonts.
Right, the fonts. But there's more options. But no, the older PDFs should open as PDF still. That's not a problem. You can go forward but not backward. Does that make sense? So if you have a PDFA and you try and turn it back into an old PDF, you can't really do that,
right,
I don't think.
Right, you can't. But there is the independent kind of people who run PDFA say that they will not supersede PDFA. There will not. There are different flavors of PDFA, but the PDFA version that you use now, there's not going to be like a weird version 7 in 5 years that makes yours obsolete, because that defeats the whole purpose. Yeah, right. Yeah, so, I mean, that's one of the things, too, you get with PDFA, is they're saying, now, is it going to last forever? Like, no, but they're at least saying that they're committed to not making that obsolete on purpose, right? Which is what...
Let's make this obsolete on purpose. Yeah, but yeah, basically, it is true. Nothing lasts forever. But the reason we digitize and we try and save this stuff is because these don't last forever. I mean, the physical photos don't last forever, so we do the best we can. We digitize them. Do the digital file types last forever? No, but we do the best we can to keep them in formats that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you... Don't ever scan in legal documents and then destroy the legal documents. Just as a disclaimer there, that's not at all what I'm saying. But I do think that it's helpful to have copies of a lot of your legal documents. But yeah, in some cases, you can't avoid loss. I mean, if you have a legal document and it is the only copy of that legal document, and for whatever reason it gets destroyed, you could have a digital copy, and that's not a replacement for that legal document because it wasn't signed and notarized as the original was. So we do the best we can, and that's all that I think that any of us can do. And hopefully I see people have written on some of their sheets, so that's very encouraging. I hope that people want to get started on things. So we do have more time. Are people getting started on this? Is anybody working on one right now? Anybody have questions about setting it up? Okay. So you know what? We're going to kind of break that off if no one else has questions. I leave you with these lovely photos of my grandmother on the right, my grandmother's brother Joe, and their next-door neighbor. And that is my grandfather right here. And some of my favorite photos from the 40s.